Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week on the show, released RFE journalist Alsu Kumashova on her colleague Farid Merilidzadeh, who is facing 12 years in prison in Azerbaijan for his reporting.
You are not alone. That's my message, and I think that would be the best message I could have ever received. You are not alone.
Also, we'll be meeting some of the young people on trial in Turkey following the recent crackdown on dissent. And taking a look at the Franco-US relationship in the run-up to D-Day. That's all here on Inside Europe. That was the moment in August last year when the Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty journalist Alsu Kumashova ran across the airport tarmac in Ankara to embrace her husband and two teenage daughters after 9 months of imprisonment in a Russian jail. Alsu was released as part of the most extensive prisoner swap since the end of the Cold War, and life since has been hard.
It's been 10 months since I was released, and I still feel the damage. And more than that, I will never be able to erase what had happened to us from my memory, from the memory of my children and my family, from the memory of my husband.
Anyone who has ever spoken to Alsu for more than 5 minutes will realise that this, for her, is the thing. Not the damage that her imprisonment inflicted on her, but the harm that it did to those who love her. And overpoweringly, the knowledge that whilst her family's nightmare may now be over, for so many others, it's not. Ever since Alsu got back from captivity, her journalistic career has been on hold. Instead, she's now a full-time advocate for colleagues imprisoned around the world. It's not easy, particularly at a time when the very existence of her organisation, Radio Free Europe, is in doubt due to a Trump-imposed funding freeze. This week, Alsu joined me via video link to talk to me about her RFE colleague, Farid Merilidzadeh, who is facing a 12-year prison sentence in Azerbaijan in a court case expected to be concluded in the coming weeks. We've covered Farid's case before on this programme. He's the young economist and RFE journalist caught up in Azerbaijan's well-documented crackdown on independent journalism, NGOs and free speech. It's almost exactly a year since Farid was arrested, and during that time, his wife, Nagiz, has given birth to a baby daughter who he has only been able to hold once, briefly.
Yes, Nagiz was present with their first baby when Farid was imprisoned. And you are a mother, and I am a mother of two. We know how important it is to be with your child, especially the first year of their life, when they change not day by day, but hour by hour. Hearing that the prosecutors wanted a 12-year sentence for him was very painful. It took me back to my sentence, where the prosecutor wanted 9 years of imprisonment for me, and I was sentenced for 6.5. 9 years is twice as long as they charge for murder in Russia. People who kill a human being get 5 or 6 years. And journalists who report the truth get 9 and 12 years. It's beyond comprehension.
Throughout your detention, Alsu, you were supported by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. And that support was happening in a very, very, very different political context to what Farid is now experiencing at a time when the very existence of your organisation is under attack, under the Trump presidency. Could you perhaps talk to me about the role that advocacy from Radio Free Europe, Radio Free Liberty, played in sustaining you and your family whilst you're in detention and also securing your release? And then perhaps talk to me about the current situation in which Fareed finds himself.
When I heard first about our FRL funding crisis and what's ahead of us, I had two thoughts immediately. And one of them was about our FRL's imprisoned journalists. What am I going to talk about next time I call their families? How will I organize, how will we organize help to the families and imprisoned journalists? How will we get them out? That was very painful. In my case, RFE played a crucial role in building a coalition of government workers of different governments, the United States, European governments united in those advocacy efforts. Press freedom groups joined efforts to advocate for me. Journalists all around the world joined in efforts to advocate for me, to write stories, to keep my name on the spotlight. Putting political pressure on the governments is very important. Every group in the society should understand that journalists cannot be imprisoned. Imprisoning a journalist is bad for the reputation of the country. Every time there are trade negotiations or any kind of other negotiations between the countries, the officials of the free world shouldn't be afraid to raise that question. When the free world unites over this issue, the problem will be solved.
You are expecting a verdict in Fareed's case very soon, possibly in the coming days. Have you, as an organization, received any contact or indication or statement on behalf of Fareed from the Trump administration?
As far as I know, there have been no official statement or anything from the government or from Trump administration. But I know RFE has support in the U.S. government, and I know RFE has support in the U.S. Congress. It's a bipartisan support, and we truly believe that RFERL can still continue its mission because RFERL works on the front lines of democracy, and that's what the United States is based on. And RFERL reporters like Fareed do their jobs at great personal risk.
Do you, Alsu, have a message for your imprisoned colleagues? And I suppose really I'm thinking particularly of their families, because realistically they are the ones who are going to be able to hear your words.
You are not alone. That's my message. And I think that would be the best message I could have ever received if I was in prison or my loved ones needed help. You are not alone. That's my message.
Alsu Komasheva was talking to me about the case of her colleague, Fareed Meralitzada, facing a 12-year sentence in Azerbaijan for, as Alsu put it, telling the truth. We'll be putting a link with more information in the show notes. In the meantime, we turn to Turkey, where multiple journalists are among hundreds of people facing trial as part of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's ongoing crackdown on dissent in the wake of the mass street protests that broke out in response to the arrest and jailing of Erdogan's main political rival, the popular Istanbul mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu, earlier this year. From Istanbul, Yelena Gostoli reports.
It's a warm and sunny day, and hundreds of people, mostly university students, have gathered outside the Istanbul courthouse of Çalayan in support of more than 180 defendants called to appear in front of the judge. Their alleged crime is taking part in an unauthorized gathering and failing to disperse.
AKP'den hesabı, eşit olacak.
of the defendants is Ali Kilic, a young man with a thin face and a moustache. He is one of nearly 2,000 people who were detained during the first week of protests. Out of that group, around 300 were later formally arrested, including seven journalists. They're now facing a range of charges, from simply being at the protest to insulting the president or covering their faces.
They try to use me as a tool to, you know, spread fear to crowd, but it backlashed because after I am detained, people found more strength and purpose to, you know, participate more actively.
Like hundreds of others, Ali was arrested in the early hours of the morning in a police raid on his home, just days after the opposition party, the CHP, had called for nightly protests at Saraçhane in front of the Istanbul municipality building. The main piece of evidence against Ali is just a photo, where he's simply standing in the crowd.
In the file, it was totally empty. And even there was a friend of mine, he participated in Kadıköy meeting, and in his file, he was just smoking.
Demokrasinin hüküm sürdüğü bir ülke için mücadele etmeye devam edeceğiz. Kurtuluş yok tek başına, ya hep beraber ya hiçbirimiz. İstanbul Emek, Barış ve Demokrasi Güçleri.
The courtroom is packed. The air feels heavy, the mood tense. Lawyers argue passionately that the right to protest is guaranteed under Turkey's own constitution. The accused files, they argue, contain no evidence of wrongdoing. A young man in a baggy jumper and loose trousers stands before the judge. He shifts nervously on his feet. Most of the other defendants are, like him, university students in their early 20s. The young man starts reading his statement, but no one among the observers in the back seats, including other lawyers and journalists, can hear him. The microphone isn't working. A woman calls out to the judge, accusing the court of failing to uphold basic procedures. It doesn't take much to tip this room into chaos. Earlier, the judge had refused to hear lawyers' objections over jurisdiction, and she and the prosecutor stormed out of the room when it broke into the chant that has accompanied the protests. There is no salvation alone, either together or none of us. The lobbying used against the defendants, Law 2911 on meetings and demonstrations, has a history. The European Court of Human Rights has struck it down multiple times. But lawyers and human rights watchdogs agree that there is something different in the way it is being used this time. Here's Emma Sinclair Webb, Europe and Central Asia Associate Director at Human Rights Watch.
What's very new in these cases is seeing people put in pre-trial detention without any evidence that they violently resisted the police. A lot of students were terribly shocked and upset by it because, you know, they're young people and this is their first time in any demonstration for a lot of them. And they were not expecting to be treated like this. There was an awful lot of ill treatment as well. You know, really, really rough treatment of them. A lot of police violence. And, you know, this was a real shock to people.
Several lawyers say the students' case files are practically empty. In some cases, they weren't even allowed to view the full video being used as evidence against them. Instead, all they got was a single still image, one frozen frame used to build a case against the accused. Lawyer Gulizar Tunjar has seen dozens of cases with her organization, the Progressive Lawyers Association, and her own son was arrested in a morning raid.
They used to look at the phones and the computers, but they didn't do that. Their purpose is not to find evidence of a crime. The purpose is to give a warning. If you walk on the street, you will be arrested because they are trying to identify people by facial recognition or by phone messages or by computers. Even the home searches, according to other operations, were not done in detail. For example, they came to our house. They didn't put their hands on their phones. They didn't look at their computers. The searches were very superficial.
reports of police violence during the protests were widespread, but gathering solid evidence has been tough, Gulizar says. DWS contacted the General Directorate of Security as well as the Justice Ministry, but received no response. As the trials drag on, the message sent by the authorities is clear. Protest comes at a price. For many of these young people, that price has already been steep. Nights in prison cells, futures put on hold, and a justice system that treats their defiance as a threat. For many, what's really on trial here is the future of democratic space in Turkey. Yelena Agostoli, DW, Istanbul.
My thanks to Yelena and all the young people who participated in that report. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Listening in the US, then you will know that this week the country marked Memorial Day, a federal holiday remembering US military personnel who died while serving in the US Armed Forces. Here in Europe, there is another big memorial event coming up, the anniversary of the D-Day landings on June 6, 1944. This year, the annual celebrations of the operation which marked the beginning of the end of World War II is taking place against a backdrop of transatlantic uncertainty. That notorious meeting with Vladimir Zelensky in the Oval Office, the contempt for Europe on full display in that leaked Signal war chat, the move to hold bilateral talks with Russia, the vocal support for far-right politicians and parties actively working against the liberal European order, it has all taken its toll and prompted France and the UK to spearhead a Coalition of the Willing initiative, which some experts are describing as a move towards NATO, but without the US. Nevertheless, when Lisa Bryant visited the village of Boubt in Normandy, US flags were hanging from some of the buildings in a region which has not forgotten the day the Americans landed.
A memorial to U.S. paratrooper Carl Beck stands outside Boubt, next to the old stone bridge he helped to save. Former Mayor Agnes Sell describes how he landed in this picturesque Normandy village early on June 6, 1944, miles from where he should have been. On a fait connaissance avec lui. Sell says her village got to know Beck during the 50th D-Day anniversary. He was looking for the place he'd parachuted down. So began a long friendship between Boubt and the D-Day veteran until Beck died in 2015 in his home state of Georgia at the age of 89. Il adorait venir ici, quoi. Nous, on le considérait comme notre grand-père après. Ça nous a fait. Sell said he returned to Boubt almost every year. The village considered him like their grandfather. J'ai retrouvé dans un tiroir dans l'atelier de mon papa. At her home nearby, where her grandparents lived during World War II, Sell shows a visitor her grandfather's diary of those years and of the battle to liberate Boubt. From her window, you can see the village church where Beck and other American troops kept watch inside the bell tower for advancing Germans. 1944, grande bataille de Boubt. Tu vois, il y a eu la grande bataille de Boubt. Sell says every June 13th, there's a commemoration at the Carl Beck Space in his honor, because if the Americans hadn't been there, she says, we would have been German today. Sel fears those D-Day bonds are fading as Europe's new generation begins to forget and pro-American sentiments cool since Donald Trump's presidency. A recent survey found just 27% of French consider the U.S. a staunch ally, the lowest level in three decades.
Et c'est inquiétant. C'est inquiétant si les Américains se retirent de tout.
It's worrying, Sel says, if the Americans withdraw from everything and if they want to be concerned only about the United States and Europe is worth nothing.
L'Europe qui vaut rien.
Things were different last D-Day. U.S. and European troops and tourists packed the town of Carentan near Beaute, a strategic crossroads during World War II. Carentan's deputy mayor, Sébastien Lenné, believes it's important not to mix up politics with people-to-people ties. He says just because relations are a bit more strained with the U.S. doesn't mean not remembering the sacrifice American soldiers made for France's liberty. Lenné talks about the exchanges between Carentan and sister city Hopkinson in Kentucky. It's located near the U.S. 101st Airborne Division, which played a key D-Day role. He says both towns are doing their small part in building transatlantic relations between France and the United States. Outside the town hall, a group of American tourists snap photos of Carentan's war memorial, where U.S. and French flags fly side by side. 71-year-old Joe Ryan is from Arkansas.
So what do you think about transatlantic relations today?
I don't know. I think they're pretty good. Of course, the current political climate kind of makes for some strained relationships, but D-Day's its own entity.
At Carentan's outdoor market, locals offer mixed views of the transatlantic alliance.
C'est triste, tout ça. C'est sûr, c'est compliqué.
Elderly resident Antoinette calls it complicated and sad. She says it's understandable that Americans want more autonomy from Europe, but she considers they did it abruptly, cavalierly. People here are still pro-American, she says. We're still thankful to the Americans for helping liberate us, but the tone has changed. Christopher Lenné, selling pots of honey at the market, says he understands American priorities. When you look at the propaganda on TV, he says, you'll hear Donald Trump is the bad guy when he's just trying to make America great again. Surviving D-Day veterans will be back in Normandy June 6th to commemorate the 81st anniversary.
Le 5 et 6 juin, c'est recopié là-dessus, tu vois. Incroyable. 25 avril.
Agnes Sell will remember her old friend, Carl Beck. But she's worried about the future. We always thought the alliance with the Americans would last forever, she says. Now we don't know. Lisa Bryant, DW. Boat, France.
If you'd like to get in touch with comments about that or any other story in the programme, then the address is insideeurope@dw.com. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany.
On Living Planet, we've got questions.
Is anyone trying to clean up this mess?
Big questions. Should we really be sinking our money into this?
Questions that get to the bottom of things.
How much CO2 does a tree absorb anyway? Your questions.
How often do you think we should use the reusable cups to compensate for the paper ones?
But don't worry, we've got answers too. Answers to help you navigate some of the biggest environmental issues of our time. That's On Living Planet.
Find us wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome to Those Who Can't Teach Anymore, a narrative podcast series that explores why teachers are leaving education and what can be done to stop the exodus. This season, we're getting a look at the year and the life of teachers from across the country through their audio journals.
Darcy Ostermiller.
This is Megan Overgoff.
This is Sophie V.
This is Charlie Blackwood.
This is Taylor Barris.
This is Iva Moss Redman.
This is David Whisker.
This is Dan Morris.
This is Amanda Smith.
Look for Those Who Can't Teach Anymore, Season 2. A different kind of the same thing.
Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio program from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. Due to a public holiday this week, our production schedule for the programme has been even tighter than usual. So rather than dilute the quality of your weekly European news fix, I've decided to hand you over into the very capable hands of my colleague Kathleen Schuster from DW's Living Planet podcast instead. The Living Planet episode that I want to share with you is all about light pollution. And on that topic, I actually have an anecdote of my own. Well over a decade ago, as a young reporter on a work experience programme, I was sent off on a PR jolly, which was being hosted by a major German pharmaceutical company, which also sponsors a well-known football club. Their point of pride was a giant LED logo pointing up at the sky, which they said proudly could be seen by planes flying overhead. "What about light pollution?" I asked. "Light what?" they said. "Never heard of it." And they laughed. Well, they may not be laughing so hard after Kathleen Schuster's had her say. That is all that I'm saying.
Good. This is the problem light.
Oh,
there is also that other little light there.
So okay. Tell me, what is so bad about this light?
So we've just come to an apartment building. There's an entrance to the apartment building, and above it, there's an LED that's not shielded at all. It's very glaring, shining straight into our eyes. And that doesn't actually allow you to find your way so well because it's so bright.
That's Dr. Chris Kaiba.
So we're going to go up and see whether they have a motion sensor.
He's really into outdoor lighting.
Ah, okay, it came on. So you can actually see where your keyhole is because there's another light that's activated by a motion sensor. But there are many examples where you have a bright light like that, that you're coming up to your house, and then you can't actually see where you want to stick your key into the door.
He's a physicist by day and a light pollution detective by night.
So this light over top of the doorway shining straight downwards is doing a lot more for us than that light that was shining sideways.
That light only seems to be illuminating the trash cans. I've asked Chris to show me around Cologne, one of Germany's brightest cities.
Well, that's the thing. It's just shining sideways, right? So if you can manage to look towards it, you see that those lights aren't directed at all, and almost half of the light is actually going up into the atmosphere where it's not needed.
A few years ago, the city of Cologne wanted to find out where light pollution was worst. Chris was part of the team enlisted to help figure this out. And after talking to Chris for a few minutes, it becomes clear. No light escapes his notice.
It's really funny, actually. My wife is always laughing because when we're going for walks on the daytime, I'm pointing out the lights that I can see that I know will turn on at night, which ones are good, which ones are bad.
When it comes to artificial lights, as far as Chris is concerned, less is more. Much, much less. Because too much light is changing nightlife on Earth. Quite literally, the life of animals and insects that thrive in the dark. So I've asked Chris to go on a night walk to see this issue through his eyes. I'm Kathleen Schuster. Okay, let's move on to other bad lights.
All right.
Chris works at a university about an hour north of here, in a city called Bochum. Neither of us knows our way around Cologne, but luckily streetlights tend to be pretty easy to find.
So the light we're looking at here, it kind of has a bit of a dip down in the glass underneath the light, and that's there in order to spread the light out more. But it's problematic because it means that some of the light will end up going up into the sky.
Chris didn't really start paying close attention to lighting until the early 2010s. He'd been researching elementary particles in Canada, and then when he moved to Berlin and was applying for a job researching carbon fluxes, he accidentally got invited to the wrong interview for a job researching light pollution, which he ended up getting.
Downwards, and that helps. The problem is, if you have a street light...
Recently, he won a Citizen Science Research Award in Germany for a worldwide study showing how from 2011 to 2022, it became harder for people across the globe to see the stars because artificial lighting has brightened the night sky by up to 10%.
it seems like there are, you know, different kind of
different colors.
Street lights. Yeah. So there's one where we're walking that are more like orange, and then the ones for the cars are a brighter yellow.
So the orange lights that you see around cities are usually high pressure sodium, sometimes low pressure sodium, but that's much less common. Those are all being phased out around the whole world in favor of LEDs. These lights we're going to see, we're going to do tests in a second to see whether or not they're LED or whether they are fluorescent. Fluorescent lights were not used very much in the United States, but in Germany they're used quite a bit. So it's a white light that you know from office buildings, for example. So let's do this test.
So what is it you're holding up there?
This is called a diffraction grating. It's basically a series of really, really tiny threads, and it splits light into its spectrum so that we can see not just the color that it seems orange to us, but rather the different parts of the spectrum. And when we hold it up to our eye and don't look directly at the light, but off to the side, what we see is a series of lines.
Chris is holding up something that looks like a small slide, like for a film projector. Except instead of dark film, it's see-through.
Yeah, this will be a good one, yeah.
And what appears is similar to the spectrum of light you'd see through a prism.
Get quite close. You see all those lines on top, like floating above?
It's kind of like these, like almost like a vertical rainbow.
Exactly.
Okay, so it's like at the top, like a streak of red and then orange, yellow.
But there's a bunch of like dots, right? It's like little pearls or something, kind of.
Yeah, it's exactly. There's more color, just like a dot of color.
So now we're going to look over here at these white lights. We'll look underneath. You want to describe what you see?
So the dots are gone. So it's just a straight line, just like a straight vertical line that looks like a rainbow.
But one part of the rainbow is a little bit missing, right? It's darker than the other part?
Yeah, it all kind of slides together much more. It's like red, almost red to yellow, very little orange, and then green, and there's less gradient between the green and the blue, like
there's
violet.
There's kind of a dark spot between the green and the blue, right?
Yeah.
So this is an LED. It's a white LED. The way white LEDs work is they start on the inside with a blue LED, and then they use a coating to make that light have longer wavelengths, and it all adds up together to be white. And the amount that you convert that blue into the longer wavelength changes what we call the color temperature of the light. So how cold or how warm it feels. The more you take the blue out, the warmer the light feels, and in general, the better it is for the environment.
Light is made up of different colors: red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. The sky appears blue because blue light waves are short and can be scattered more easily by tiny air molecules. Blue light helps regulate circadian rhythms in us humans and also in animals, insects, and even plants. This is where LEDs come in. About 20% of global energy consumption goes to illuminating our streets, our homes, and everything else that we want to see clearly at night. That translates to roughly 5% of global greenhouse emissions. And this has made LEDs an attractive way to reduce emissions because they're more efficient and tend to be cheaper. But it also means more blue light. And the question of how much more is really hard to answer. By some estimations, light pollution has gone up by at least 49% since the early 90s. And one study argues that this number might even be as high as 400% in some parts of the world. But it's hard to say because not all satellites can detect the blue wavelengths emitted by LED lights. And the ones that can don't take images often enough for scientists to put together a good timeline.
Before you install a light, the question should be, who is it for? And if it's for somebody who comes very infrequently, then having a timer or using motion sensors might be a really good approach. If it's in a very high traffic area, then maybe it makes sense to leave on all night. There's no one answer for exactly what you should do. It's very context dependent. But it always should start with this question, who is the light for and what do they need?
Okay, let's keep walking.
We stumble upon one of Cologne's darkest corners, a park, right in the middle of it all.
There's a cyclist coming across the lawn, and I feel like that light is just going straight into my eyes. But, you know, looking up, I was trying to see if we could actually see any stars from here.
It's cloudy. We would be able to see stars. So
there is a lot of sky glow.
Yeah. Well, this is how we're actually seeing. It's not the light coming from the sides of the park that's allowing us to see things. It's the glow of the sky itself because of all the artificial light going up and coming down. So on a clear night, we would actually probably be able to see a little bit less well than today. But even still, sky glow is very, very bright compared to starlight, and human beings in open areas can get around by starlight, right? So once you give your eyes the chance to adapt.
Europe has some of the worst light pollution in the world. Cologne lies in a heavily populated urban corridor in Germany. From here, the Milky Way is no longer visible, and this problem is similarly bad in other European countries. It would take traveling hundreds of kilometers northwest to Scotland or south to the island of Corsica to escape it. Sky glow is part of this problem, and when it's cloudy, the skies can even brighten up to 10 times more.
Can you tell what that... Okay, no, we can't. Can you tell what color that bag is?
I would have said pink, but I don't know how we can confirm. Yeah. It's too dark.
Yeah, it's too dark. Okay, so I want to tell you something about moonlight.
Yeah, tell me about moonlight.
Okay.
On this night where we can't see the moon at all.
So if you go out on a night with full moonlight and take a book with you and see if you can read it, you might just be barely able to. If the moon is not quite full, you won't be able to read it. You'll feel like you should be able to because you go outside and you'll say everything seems so bright. But you're seeing then with the rods in your eyes and not the cones. And the cones in the central fovea are what we use to read. We use the very center of our eyes to read and not the outer parts. And so we have this impression that we should be able to read because we can see everything so well. But reading requires that color vision, and it's not bright enough for the color vision to function at night. And so it's really kind of surprising. But if you have a night where the moon is all the way full, you'll notice that actually you are start to be able to see a few colors, especially red becomes quite obvious. And you are, if you have unimpaired vision, able to actually read text that's sort of a normal font size.
You were part of a research project to do with light pollution in Cologne. Could you show me on your phone those pictures that you brought with you?
Yeah, no problem. I have to find them first.
Yeah, no worries. My eyes have to adjust for a second. Hold on. Tell me again, what was the research that you guys were helping conduct?
So the environmental agency in Cologne was interested in understanding what the status quo is with lighting in Cologne. So they got us to fly over the city and take thousands of pictures and stitch them together into a giant map that shows how much light is going upwards in all the different parts of the cities. And we did this with a regular camera with red, green, and blue, but we also used an infrared camera and an ultraviolet camera to get a sense over the broader spectrum because for a lot of organisms, they're able to see into the near infrared or in the ultraviolet.
Okay, and so you have kind of like a GIF on your phone where we can see different streets lighting up. So what exactly are we seeing here?
So what we're seeing here is I made an animation to switch between the visible picture and the infrared picture, and then back to the visible and then to the ultraviolet. Because the ultraviolet is so infrequent, if you just have the map by itself, it's just a bunch of dots and you can't really place it in context. So that's why I like to have the visible picture there as well. One moment while we bring the picture back. So when we see the switch from the visible to infrared, what we see is that some light...
What they found was that over a third of the city's light pollution came from streets, parking, and residential areas. Buildings were generally about 70% brighter than the city average. And the worst type of light for insects, UV light, tended to come from hotels, restaurants, and churches.
Just kind of in broad strokes, what exactly is the problem with light pollution when it comes to our environment?
So when life evolved, it had a regular switch from daytime to nighttime. And that was really important for early life to adapt to that. And for hundreds of millions of years, we had sort of the same conditions all the time throughout the months and throughout the seasons. And now all of a sudden, the light environment at night is completely different from the way it was during this entire evolutionary period. And so that really throws a lot of organisms for a loop. Because it's just not what they expect, and their body is expecting something different and could be fooled by this light that's there at the wrong time or in the wrong place. And so the really classic example of this, of course, is moths attracted to a flame. That flame isn't supposed to be there normally in the natural environment. And that means that they are not looking for food, they are not looking for mates, they're sort of stuck. And in the worst case, they become exhausted and die and sort of remove that biomass from the ecosystem.
Chris has been working together with an animal ecologist named Dr. Jana Eckhardt on these questions of light pollution and biodiversity. Jana works at the University of Potsdam outside of Berlin and says if you want to know how we are impacting insects with our lights, just look at your regular black beetles.
My interest in beetles was triggered with these little LED garden lights. They are put to places where you need a bit light to see the step in your garden, or you want to illuminate the path. And these are usually these little garden lights that illuminate the ground. And I was wondering what all these animals that walk on the ground, whether or not they are affected by this small garden lights. And until recently, the gardens and the parks in our cities were the dark refuges for all these little night creatures. And now suddenly you can buy these LED lights everywhere and people just put them out everywhere. If you now walk through Berlin and look at the gardens, they look completely different. They have all these little light sources everywhere. And this is a new threat to all the animals on the ground. And these predatory ground beetles are a group that is very well researched because for decades they have been indicator species for habitat quality, for habitat moisture, for pollution.
Jana and her team placed solar-powered LED garden lamps in a dark sky reserve outside Berlin to see how beetles would respond. They found two main results. One, there were some beetles that gathered around the light and got stuck. This is a common problem with insects and means that they're more likely to be eaten by spiders, toads, and bats. The other outcome was that some of the beetles avoided the light altogether and reduced their nighttime activity. And in both cases, this echoes a general concern that distracted insects stop doing what they do best, foraging and mating. And this can ultimately reduce their population size and have widespread knock-on effects.
Because they eat pests. They eat caterpillars, they eat all kinds of other herbivorous beetles, so other beetles that eat plants. So they are active at night and eat lots of things that you don't want to have in your garden. So that could be a straight impact because the food chain is changed. And in this case, the predator, the group of predators, the group of animals that control other animals is affected.
Another knock-on effect that researchers want to prevent is the impact on nocturnal pollinators, like moths. Authors of a study from the UK in 2020 have pointed out moths that pollinate at night could help stabilize agricultural ecosystems at a time when daytime pollinators, like bees, are dying out. Jana says animals farther up the food chain, like voles, are being affected too. And if you need something to brighten your day, do yourself a favor and Google this animal. It's like a mouse, but cuter. That's vole, V-O-L-E. One impact she and her team found was that artificial light and sky glow made the voles shift their foraging activities from the night to the daytime.
We don't see that much biodiversity, partly because a huge proportion of biodiversity is active at night, and we don't see it. Some people say more than 60% of the insects are nocturnal. So we underestimate activity of nocturnal animals. We underestimate how important they are. We underestimate their biodiversity, and we massively disturb it with artificial light at night.
Berlin. Olaf Scholz is getting on the plane. I'll be on board as well, and I'll brief you at Berlin Briefing.
Berlin is right in the middle of the global tensions of our time.
Between East and West, autocrats and Democrats, Germany's whole system is under stress. Politics is getting angry. We break it all down with experts and political players. And we decode what it means for you.
It's all in our new podcast, Berlin Briefing. Listen on all platforms.
The park Chris and I are walking through is almost entirely absent of any lights.
Would you say this is a very good example of what things should be like?
So when we think about urban planning, we really need to think holistically about everyone, the people who live there and the environment. In Germany, it's very typical that most of the parks are not illuminated, and these are very important refuges for urban animals. In certain cases, it may make sense if you have a very high use of people and you want to encourage more people to use a park, that you illuminate that park. But in the sort of holistic city planning, you don't illuminate every park. And in that way, you do have areas where people who are more concerned about lighting have a way to go to the park at night. But you also preserve this area for nature, but also for the enjoyment of people who enjoy being out in the dark. There's this enjoyment of the night that is missing in a lot of places that I feel in Germany is a lot easier to find, actually, than in a lot of other wealthy countries.
You know, I'm really tempted to go up to one of these people who are who are walking through the park or biking. No, I think I would scare them half to death if I came out of nowhere with a microphone.
No, if we're just standing there talking.
No.
I can do the excuse me, you know, no problem.
No, that's okay.
If we just go on the path, then people will see us as they walk by.
No, that's okay.
Sure?
Yeah, okay. No, I really don't want to scare them.
What I would love, though, is just to check out, if we can, just for fun, what the gender breakdown of people is. Because what I will bet you is that there are a bunch of women also using the park.
Okay.
Even though it's not illuminated.
I'll take that bet. Okay, let's see.
Hard to tell. Would you walk through a park like this in Germany or no? Yourself?
By myself?
Yeah.
No way. Okay. No way. Let's see. We've seen a few women walk by. We saw a mother and daughter. Mm-hmm. But the joggers, I think, have all been men. And on bikes, I would be willing to say on bikes it would be not that big of a difference, because you're on a bike, you can get away.
Two women
running together, though.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Strength in numbers.
But also with no headlight.
Yeah. Right?
So they.
But I think because they're together, that would be my bet.
No, of course. No.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But the point is just this one, that there's this common understanding that if an area is unlit, people will fall down and die. And I've even seen this written in German news media before, that a landowner was concerned that someone might fall and trip and die. The truth is, if you're in an area that's not lit, and especially if you've given yourself a moment to adapt, there's so much light simply from the sky itself that you can get around relatively safely as long as you don't have a vision impairment.
But I'm also wondering, in this environment, so, you know, it's nice and dark here, but as you can hear in the background, there's a ton of traffic. We're in one of the biggest traffic rings in the city. And so there's lots of light from that. And then in the distance, we see more light. So does it make that big of a difference if there are small pockets of space that are kind of more protective for biodiversity? Or is it kind of like, well, there's such a large scale problem, this is just, you know, a drop in the bucket?
No, I think it really does matter, actually, for the parks to be not illuminated. But the distance that some insects and other organisms travel is not really large. And if you're thinking, for example, also of a bird that nests in a nest they built in the tree, it's going to be a really big difference whether that light is, like here in our case, it's maybe 50 or 100 meters away, to if the light is right in the park, in terms of, you know, how they sleep in their nest. So having these pockets of darkness, I think, really is actually important for biodiversity. And in Europe, there's a little bit of a movement to try to link these dark things in the same way that we try to create green corridors for animals to navigate through the environment, also to create dark corridors so that animals that are active at nighttime have a way to move around through the environment. For bats, for example, it's really important to have these linkages between where they sleep and where they eat. And so these kinds of parks and things can become part of a dark corridor for that perspective.
Eventually, the bright lights of the city draw us back in.
We have to cross the street here really quickly while we can.
Chris wants to check out an LED hotspot he saw in his aerial photos. It's a soccer field, but whether the lighting is good or bad remains to be seen.
One of the things that we see here is that we're standing almost directly beneath one of the lights, and it is not glaring, and we're standing in a really moderate amount of light, because this is a highly asymmetric light. It's shining its light on the field, and it is trying to avoid shining it onto the surrounding areas.
Yeah, it's interesting looking up at it, because it looks like it has
shields.
Are those, yeah, four like metal shields on each side, and so you can look at it. Of course, you shouldn't look straight at it, but it's not completely blinding. That's true. I wouldn't have I don't think I would have noticed that if you hadn't said anything.
But sports lighting can be really, really problematic, especially for neighbors. Even up to a kilometer away, it can be really, really problematic if you're not maintaining the light in the sports area. So this is really an example of, like, this is the kind of world we're imagining. You still have the illumination, you're still able to use the sports field, but you're really reducing the amount of light that's going into the environment.
He's got somewhere to be.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's an older kind of light.
We head back to the quieter street where we began this episode to track down one last light when something else catches our attention.
Oh, hey, I see the moon. Do you see the moon?
Oh, yeah, nice.
It's pretty... Actually, it looks so strange because it looks...
It's mostly behind the clouds.
Yeah, but the clouds around it aren't really illuminated. It's just this fuzzy, bright spot in the night sky. Yeah. Watch out for the glass.
So the funny thing is, if we were in a natural area right now, with that moon there like that, even though it's cloudy, we would be able to see quite well once we let our eyes adapt. And so there's this great quote from an article about industrialization. They talked about the mayor of Bochum, Max Grieve. He was the mayor of Bochum for 30 years during industrialization and when the city got its first street lighting. And then what this historian said is he fought the rest of his life against the absurd modernism that would leave the lights on even when the moon was shining.
Light pollution impacts at least 80% of the world's population. In Europe, it's nearly 100%. And while, as Chris pointed out in this episode, most of our lighting problems are at a large scale beyond our individual choices, there are still a few things we can do to help the ecosystem in our own backyards. The first question you should ask yourself when using an outdoor light at night is, what is this light actually for? Is it for safety? Is it for decoration? What's its purpose? Two, if it's a light you absolutely need, can it be put on a timer or installed with a motion sensor? Could it be dimmed? Cheap LEDs tend to be problematic because of the intense blue light they give off, but there are some higher quality options on the market too. Three, is the light illuminating a larger area than is necessary? For example, is it going up straight into the atmosphere or going sideways for no particular reason? The more you can direct your light, the better. And finally, can you create safe havens in your backyard or garden to shield animals and insects from the light? Some researchers have suggested that trees, for example, can provide an island of shade for creatures that live in the dark. The same goes for ponds or any other body of water you might have in your backyard. Keep the light off of that too if you can.
Lights out for our sojourn with Living Planet. The episode you just heard is actually the first installment of a two-part series on light pollution, and you can find both episodes on the Living Planet podcast feed, along with a whole host of other environmental stories. Inside Europe is, of course, also available on all the other usual podcast platforms too. Last week, we wanted you to guess the name of Iceland's richest man. Well, thanks to listener Pál Ólafsson, I can reveal that the correct answer was...
Björgólfur Thor Björgólfsson.
Thanks, Pál. This week, we want to know what the code name for D-Day was. Was it Operation Overlord, Operation Quiet Landing, or Operation Inward Tide? Head on over to Spotify to take part in the poll. Do you have an idea for an Inside Europe quiz question? Drop us a line at insideeurope@dw.com. Or, even better, why not record it as a voice note and see if it gets broadcast? I'll be back with Inside Europe next week. This episode was produced by me, Kate Laycock, with help from Charlie Shield. Our sound technicians were Michael Springer, Thomas Schmidt and Wissam Dahlman. Extra thanks this week go to Lavinia Pitu and Sanja Blagojevic. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.